Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and His Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-1038, Stephen J. Horning, Petitioner versus Securities and Exchange Commission. Mr. Berg for the petitioner, Mr. Frieda for the respondent.
Mr. Berg.
Good morning, and may it please the court, I am Tom Burge. I represent Stephen J. Horning, the appellant in this case, and the respondent in the case below, and I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, if I might. I'd like to focus on three issues that are key to my client's appeal, the first being the misreading of the auditor's report on internal controls, the second being the sanction, the part of the sanction that barred my client from acting as a salesperson for 1 year in the securities industry, and the third being the commission allowing the Division of Enforcement at the trial court level or at the administrative level to change its position on sanctions in the middle of the hearing.
Can I ask you on one topic that you're apparently not going to be talking about? You had an argument about the vagueness of SEPA Section 14B.
Yes, Your Honor.
I may not understand this correctly. It seemed to me that the sanctions in this case were independently rested both on that and on Exchange Act 15B. Is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So, and there's no element of the sanction that came from 14B rather than 15B?
That is correct.
So why does it make any difference whether a SEPA is vague? You don't make a claim that 15B is vague, do you?
I do not, Your Honor. It only makes a difference if the court decides that the sanction can't be upheld under the 34 Act and then decides to look at the SIPA claim to see if the sanction can be upheld under the SIPA claim.
But the claim under the 34 Act is not based on vagueness in any way.
It is not.
All right.
It is not.
Thank you.
Focusing on the auditor's report on internal controls, because the commission in its opinion and throughout in this entire case relied on the theory that this report on internal controls was a warning to Mr. Horning that things were amiss, and it turns out that the report says just the opposite, that factual finding by the commission, which then, in their opinion, they rely on to support their conclusion, both that the sanction is appropriate.
When you say just the opposite, you mean what exactly?
Well, the auditor's report says to the reader that I, the auditor, have tested the internal controls for the broker-dealer as it relates to their net capital calculation, their control over securities, their books and records, and their reserve requirement, a specific calculation that's required by a broker-dealer under the 34 Act. Now, the reason that that's so important is that those are the four things that the commission found that Mr. Horning had caused to be violated. The audit is done in the middle of the scheme that's going on. The two individuals who committed the scheme are now convicted felons and are serving time. But the auditor, in his report, tells the reader, including Mr. Horning, that based on the statute, based on the standards that I apply, the procedures and the internal controls that control the exact same features that were eventually used by these felons to steal the money are in place and operating adequately.
What about the sentence, the company's plan of organization did not include adequate separation of duties related to daily cash receipt and cash disbursement activities?
Your Honor, that relates to a simple function of having the same person paying the bills and receiving the bills. Now, if this had been a situation where the person paying the bills and receiving the bills had stolen the money, that is to say, they wrote themselves some checks and cashed them and stole the money?
If I understood it correctly, the problem did arise out of the dishonest employee's handling of the Reich and Tang accounts, right?
That's correct, Your Honor, and those are securities, not cash.
Well, they're certainly securities, but I'm looking at page 684 of the Joint Appendix, which is a page from the financial statements of Rocky Mountain Securities. And Note 9 has cash and cash equivalents, a million and some odd. So that's got to be the Reichen Tang account, no?
It is not, Your Honor.
It's not.
Definitely
okay.
Not.
All right.
The Reichen Tang account, Your Honor, does not show up on the balance sheet anywhere.
I see.
So money market account is not a cash equivalent?
Not according to the way it was accounted for here, Your Honor. This is a, I guess I would call it an antiquated money market system, because the money market was actually held at Reichen Tang, which was its separate broker-dealer. So it was an omnibus account held by the broker-dealer that didn't show up then as a cash or a cash equivalent on Rocky Mountain's balance sheet.
Well, at least under a normal accounting, a money market account would be regarded as a cash equivalent, wouldn't it?
Certainly under...
In the way that ordinary people think of the words, what else would be a cash equivalent? I understand what cash is. Isn't a money market a cash equivalent?
Money market,
especially if it's if it can be withdrawn at any time, no limitations, no penalties.
In sort of the not in this case, but in the abstract, it would be considered a money market or a cash equivalent. Yes, and there are other examples of a cash equivalent.
But your argument is that that sentence in the auditor's report has nothing to do with the Reichen Tang?
Precisely, Your Honor.
Why do you think that? Because my understanding was that it was precisely a problem, at least one feature was the absence of separation of duties relating to the Reichen Tang account that led to the problem. Am I wrong on that?
Your Honor, respectfully, I believe that you are wrong, and here's why. The Reichen Tang account, under the Commission's accounting rules and regulations regarding net capital and possession and control of securities, says that the Reichen Tang account is to be treated as a security, not as cash. And therefore, the procedures that applied to the Reichen Tang account, the possession and control requirement, the net capital and the books and records requirements that will apply to securities, are all the procedures that the accountant says are sufficient and meet the Commission's objectives as set forth in his report. So there's a finding in the Commission's opinion, Your Honor, that says the Reichen Tang account is a security. It's not cash. So therefore, the auditor's comment that deals strictly with cash receipts and disbursements does not address the fundamental issue in this case, which was the malfunction as it deals with the handling of the Reichen Tang account.
So, I mean, I guess you saw this, your client saw this observation in the auditor's report, and what did he then do?
Your Honor, after which observation?
The observation about separation of duties relating to handling cash.
He took no steps in response to that comment in the auditor's report.
So he didn't inquire what the auditor had in mind. If he took no steps, that must follow.
Well, they had previously discussed it early on in about 1987 or 88, Your Honor, I believe, about what it meant and how it related to this particular issue.
This is 2002, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor. It was a comment.
Legacy of 1987 would have been very faint.
The testimony in the record was that my client spoke to the auditor early on in one of the earlier audits about the subject matter and how it dealt with cash receipts and disbursements, and he didn't do anything to separate those functions as they relate to cash receipts and disbursements.
I guess I'm not exactly sure of what the point here is. It seemed to me that the Commission's opinion indicates that what it's doing is saying, look, the auditor found these kinds of problems, not necessarily the exact same problems as the ones that occurred here, but a series of problems about plan of organization not including adequate separation of duties, appropriate supervisory procedures were not instituted to provide reasonable assurance, and then nothing was done about those things. Similarly, there were Clark's and Andrade's misconduct, not exactly the same as the misconduct in this situation, but still required heightened supervision, and heightened supervision didn't go forward. So whether or not it was precisely the same problem, it's an indication that your client, notwithstanding warnings, was unwilling or unable or negligent about providing the kind of supervision required. And I don't understand why that's not a reasonable thing for the commission to conclude.
Well, Your Honor, it's not a reasonable thing for the commission to conclude because the warning that they refer to from the auditor's letter isn't a warning at all. It just is limited to the cash receipts and disbursements, and there's the language that describes the internal
procedure.
But
it suggests that something should be done, and your client didn't do anything, or he didn't solve those problems, because we have both a 2000 and a 2002 auditor letter both saying the same thing. So the failure to respond to an auditor's letter describing a problem that is more than a relatively low risk that the errors will be material in relation to the financial statements means a failure of supervision. Now, it's not exactly the same supervision, but it's now repeated. There's the auditor problem, there's the prior unlawfulness of Clark and Andrade. How's the other name pronounced?
Andrade.
And then your client actually establishes some mechanisms that might have caught the third and the worst problem, and then fails to keep up on those either. Why is this an unreasonable chain of logic on the part of the SEC?
Well, Your Honor, because the commission relies on this auditor's opinion, which it's not a warning, and in fact, it's just the opposite. The report on internal control says everything regarding the controls related to the Reich and Tang account is in place and is operating. And because they relied on that, and it's not really it's not an accurate reading of that report, then that vitiates their entire conclusion.
I don't understand. Show me the sentence in the SEC's opinion that is troubling you in this respect. Which sentence?
Your Honor, I don't have it in front of me.
When
but
you come back on
I will. I've cited it three times, and there's three separate citations to the record about how the commission reads this as a warning. And reading the entire document,
it clearly is a warning. It may not be a warning of exactly what happened wrong in this case, but don't you regard this as a warning? The statement that says, our study and evaluation disclosed the following conditions that we believe result in more than a relatively low risk that errors or irregularities in amounts that would be material in relation to the financial statements may occur and not be detected. That's a warning of something, isn't it?
Not when it's read in connection with the internal controls report, Your Honor, which is a separate report, as well as the three supplemental schedules that come with the report that say the net
cap. Does it say never mind with respect to this statement?
It does not, Your Honor, but it has to be read in the entire context of
even in the context of the entire statement. Is there anything in any additional document that says there, in fact, isn't a risk of errors and irregularities that would result in material misstatements of the financial statements? Is there anything that says the opposite?
But it says, Your Honor, that the net capital calculation and the customer reserve requirement were accurately done and performed.
Does that say anything about the problem that the auditor reflects in the third to last paragraph of his letter?
It doesn't change that, but I think it does have to be read in context because the report on internal controls and the three separate schedules suggest to, if you read the whole document front to end, it suggests that things are operating fine in the back office of Rocky Mountain.
If things are operating fine, why did your client establish these requirements of reviewing the reconciliation reports and the trade error reports? Why did he adopt those things?
That's something that the auditor doesn't test, Your Honor.
Right. That's something that arose out of the first set of violations.
Correct.
Right. Now,
correct.
Is it correct when the SEC says that he spent only 10 seconds once a week reviewing the reconciliation reports? He did not review the NSCC daily report or the Rocky Mountain trading reports attached to the summary sheet. He did not add up the columns on the summary sheets. He failed to notice obvious discrepancies on the face of the summary sheets. And these are all summary sheets that he initialed. Are all those things true?
Yes, they are, Your Honor.
Well, why isn't that alone enough to conclude he failed reasonably to supervise?
Well, it may be, Your Honor, if they hadn't improperly relied on the auditor's report as a warning. That is not something that they've articulated in their opinion. If they're wrong on the auditor's report, then they would have to come back and explain why, without the auditor's report in the mix of information, it constitutes unreasonable supervision.
Okay. Mr. Frieda.
Morning. Dominic Frieda on behalf of the Securities and Exchange Commission. One thing I'd like to establish at the beginning is that in order to be found to have failed to supervise, essentially the Commission defines this as a failure to supervise is what is unreasonable within the circumstances. According to the statute, the Commission looks at whether or not you had adequate procedures and whether you discharged your duties under those procedures in a reasonable manner. The Commission's determination that Mr. Horning acted unreasonably and that his unreasonable conduct led or allowed these violations to occur, the anti-fraud violations, depended on both prongs of this test. First, the Commission found that the procedures at Rocky Mountain were inadequate, and it found in addition, and I would argue that that's an independent ground for its determination, that his discharge of his duties under those procedures was wholly inadequate. Opposing counsel, and I wrote this down from his argument, essentially argues that the fundamental issue in this case is whether the auditor's warning led to a causal chain regarding the failure to supervise. And that's just a fundamental misreading of the Commission's opinion. The auditor's warning was in two respects. First, the auditor noted that, and I think the court has a good grasp of this, that there was a problem in the internal controls within the cash receipt and disbursement activities. And in addition, the second sentence is that there's inappropriate supervisory review procedures were not instituted to provide reasonable assurance that adopted policies and prescribed procedures were adhered to. The Commission, in finding that Mr. Horning's procedures that he set up for Rocky Mountain were unreasonable or inadequate.
Can I just pause over that?
Sure.
As I understand their argument, it is that that second sentence refers to the previous sentence. That is, it's appropriate supervisory review procedures relative to cash receipt and cash disbursement activities. You agree with that or disagree with that?
I disagree with that.
So the Commission's reading is that this is a separate problem.
Yes.
Problem one, inadequate separation of duties related to cash disbursements. Problem two, appropriate supervisory review procedures.
Yes, that's right.
Now, is the Commission's view about that, and that's the view of in the opinion?
Yes.
Right? And is that based just on the reading of this audit? Is it based on the Commission's experience of reading other audits? Is it based on, I don't even know whether there was a deposition of this auditor, what?
My understanding from the opinion is that it's based upon a reading of the audit. The Commission didn't note that it was using its expertise in reading the audit language or that this was standard audit language. I don't know beyond the four corners of the opinion.
There wasn't a deposition or anything of the auditor?
The auditor, I believe, testified at the hearing, but I don't recall his testimony regarding these two sentences. What I can say is that throughout the proceedings, the ALJ and the Commission both read these two sentences as being separate. And more importantly, the Commission clearly set forth in the opinion that it understood that these two were separate and that it wasn't confusing the difference between cash disbursements and what caused the violations here. As you noted, Judge Garland, it was merely demonstrating that Mr. Horning had been warned of these deficiencies on multiple occasions and never took any action to resolve them.
And that is a reflection of a general failure to supervise
Absolutely.
Rather than a failure to supervise on the particular thing that led to the disaster.
Yes, exactly. Because, as I said, there's really two prongs to the commission's analysis, and the first one is whether you have adequate procedures. Well, this demonstrates the inadequacy of the procedures at the firm. If you then go on to look at his wholly inadequate discharge of his duties under these procedures, and particularly the ones that he instituted as purported remedial procedures after Clark and Andrade had committed their first unauthorized trading scheme.
In your view, were these remedial procedures themselves inadequate, or was it his implementation of them?
It was both, and that's the commission's view, and it's the position the commission set forth in the opinion. The procedures themselves were inadequate, partly because they created perverse incentives for Clark to, if she were to commit unauthorized trades, to actually increase her the number of times that she would do it, because it reduced her commissions, and also had the disincentive for her coworkers to actually come forth with information if she had begun unauthorized training again. But in addition to that, the reconciliation reports themselves and his implementation of them in particular, his lack of a review of them, his failure to do math on them or to look at the backup materials that Andrade attached to each and every one of them, those were the wholly inadequate supervision. And I would also point out that the Reich and Tang account, the failure to reconcile those account statements that came in daily, was something that his own expert witness conceded was an inadequacy, and it was unreasonable supervision in light of that.
But the commission doesn't contend at all that this sentence in the auditor's report relating to cash receipt and cash disbursement activities had anything to do with what eventuated.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
And Reich and Tang, you agree, you're both in agreement, that's not a cash equivalent for purposes of this discussion?
For purposes of this discussion, no. Yeah. As the commission found, it's a security for purposes of this discussion. Now, there may be instances, I'm not saying that his...
No, for purposes of the, maybe a security, but for purposes of the, whatever the auditor meant, there, he wasn't referring to that.
It looks like the auditor thought that the... I would say it's a bit unclear, but I'm willing to concede that the auditor thought that this was a security for purposes of his warning. Whether or not he accounted for it properly as a security is another matter.
Okay. Can I just to be sure I'm also clear on the leading question I began with opposing counsel. 15B and 14B are independent?
Yes.
So why wasn't your answer to the vagueness question that it doesn't matter because nobody argues that 15B is vague?
I thought our brief did set out that it was an independent ground. So I thought
but
it was
your answer
implicit
to vagueness was it was implicit in it.
Right. Yeah. I think it was implicit in that.
Maybe giving the court more credit than at least this member of the court.
Or I may be misremembering our brief. That could be the case. Right. But we wanted to defend the fact that it wasn't vague according to this court's decision in Dirks. But in addition, if it were to be found or if the court didn't want to reach that issue, you could uphold the sanction based upon 15B alone.
Okay. There appear to be no more questions from the court.
Well, thank you.
Mr. Birch? How much time does Mr. Birch have? Okay, Mr. Birch, we'll give you 2 minutes, but I'd like those 2 minutes to be spent telling me the exact... I've looked at the brief, which cites a number of pages, but not specific sentences. Which sentences of the SEC Commission opinion do you think are inaccurate with respect to the auditor?
Specifically, Your Honor, it's on page 20 of the Commission's decision in the first paragraph. It's not the first full paragraph. There's a sentence. He ignored warnings from Rocky Mountain's auditors and Commission staff about inadequate supervision.
I'm sorry, just which line? Page 20 line. He ignored warnings, right?
Yes.
But that's true. He did ignore warnings. That is,
it's
the auditor described the things that we talked about, whether they're related to the current problem or not, and we get a second auditor, at least one more auditor letter reflecting exactly the same problems. Doesn't that mean he ignored the warnings?
It doesn't, Your Honor. They're not. The auditor's report says the internal controls that are important are operating adequately. And to answer the court's earlier question about the auditor and did he testify, he did in fact testify. His work papers were put into evidence, and his work papers suggest that he did test the procedures with respect to the Reichentang account and found them adequate.
But I guess I'm still hung up on this. It says the company's plan of organization did not include separation of duties related to daily cash receipt and cash disbursement activities. Were those duties later separated?
They were not, Your Honor.
All right, so why isn't that ignoring a warning? It may not be the cosmic warning. It may not be the world is coming to an end warning, but it is a warning, isn't it?
It is a warning, Your Honor, but it doesn't, you know, I'm repeating myself, okay, right, but it's inherent in the term of warning. It didn't warn him of the thing that went wrong. It was a general warning of cash receipts and disbursements.
Then take the following sentence from the auditor's report. That, too, was ignored. No?
It relates to the cash receipts and disbursements, Your Honor, and it does.
Well, that's your contention, and the SEC read it otherwise. But let's assume it's ambiguous. Certainly the ambiguity is not one that Mr. Horning explored to get to the bottom of it.
He did not, Your Honor.
But partly because with reference to the completely concrete thing, he did nothing. So it was completely natural for him not to go on and do anything with respect to the seemingly vaguer observation.
Again, but it just relates to the cash receipts and disbursements, not the things that went wrong.
That's your contention. I mean, it seems to me certainly ambiguous.
Well, but if you look at the regulation that governs these reports, 17A5, I believe it is, I've cited it in the brief. It deals specifically what the auditor is supposed to test that's away from the financial statements. It's supposed to test with these specific procedures that broker-dealers are supposed to follow when they handle people's securities. And that's the internal control procedure that was tested by the auditor. The auditor said it met commission objectives. And that is key to this case because that's where the commission found that Mr. Horning improperly conducted his supervision with respect to those specific procedures, which the auditor found were in operable condition and operating in accordance with the objectives of the commission.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Case will be submitted.
Case number 07-5391, Wendy A. Oscarson versus Office of the Senate Sergeant at Arms, Appellant. Ms. Bach for the appellant, Mr. Kuman for the appellee.
May it please the court. My name is Stacey Bach, and I represent the Office of the Senate Sergeant at Arms. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. The district court lacks subject matter jurisdiction because, first, Ms. Oscarson failed to meet her burden of showing that jurisdiction was proper. And second, the facts in the record, as set forth by Ms. Oscarson and taken as true by the Senate Sergeant at Arms, make clear that as a matter of law, she failed to timely exhaust administrative remedies after her claim accrued, which is a jurisdictional prerequisite to suit and an express condition on Congress's waiver.
When you say lack subject matter jurisdiction, you realize that that is rarely, if ever, a ground for interlocutory review, right?
I do, Your Honor.
For example, if this were a diversity case and it turns out that the district court wrongly concluded that there was diversity, there wouldn't be an immediate appeal, right? There would be a trial, and then we would consider that question.
Your Honor, in this case, however, there's a sovereign immunity overlay with respect to 12B1. And when you look at the Congressional Accountability Act, the two analyses actually converge.
Okay, so if this weren't a so whether assume for the moment, as you are, that if it's jurisdictional, you get an interlocutory appeal. Would you agree that if it's not jurisdictional, that is, if it's not a jurisdictional element of this cause of action, that you would not get an interlocutory appeal? That the only thing that could possibly permit an interlocutory appeal here is if this had to do with the court's jurisdiction. If this were just an element of the cause of action, for example.
Well, to the extent the court views this as an element of the waiver of sovereign immunity, there's...
Well, when you say, that's what I'm trying to get, when you say it's an element of the sovereign immunity, I mean, theoretically, you could be saying every single aspect of the cause of action here is such an element, which would mean that every time the district court makes a decision on anything, one by one, we would have to hear it interlocutorily. You're not making that argument, are you?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying that the elements that are expressly set forth in the jurisdictional grant as part and parcel of the condition on the waiver of immunity.
And if they weren't, if this particular one, that's the timeliness of the going to the counselor, were not in the jurisdictional grant, then you would agree there would be no interlocutory appeal. Is that right?
I believe that's right, Your Honor.
So then can we look together at the jurisdictional grant?
Sure, Your Honor.
That's 1408A. And that says, title jurisdiction, first sentence, the court shall have jurisdiction over any civil action commenced under section 1404 by a covered employee who has completed counseling under section 1402. It doesn't say who has completed counseling in a timely manner. It doesn't say who asked for counseling in a timely manner. It just says completed counseling, right?
It says specifically, Your Honor, under 1402.
Yes.
And that plain language evinces Congress's intent to incorporate all of the requirements that are set forth in section 1402.
Well, you got me with, I like the words plain language, but the evinces part doesn't get me there. It doesn't say anything about all aspects of 1402. It just says who has completed counseling under 1402. What? Why would it have to? I mean, there are a number of Supreme Court opinions, Irwin and Scarborough versus Principi, all about time limits, all which say that these are not jurisdictional, that these instead are equitable tolling. I guess the Harbor, I think the YNR Harbor or whatever that one's called, all of which say that unless Congress quite clearly says that a timing question is jurisdictional, we're to regard it as an element of cause of action or an exhaustion requirement or something that can be equitably told. And this jurisdictional section does not say anything about timeliness.
Well, let me first address the Irwin issue. In Irwin, Your Honor, the court was not construing a jurisdictional grant, which is completely different than the situation in 1408.
But there was a jurisdictional grant. It's just that the timing part wasn't in it. And that's the question here.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's exactly right. The timeliness provision was not at issue in the jurisdictional grant in Irwin. That's what makes this case different.
Well, that only makes it different if it is at issue in this one. And I'm asking you to, you know, other than your statement that it's plain, which doesn't appear to me to be plain, what is it that's telling you that Congress meant something more than just completing the counseling?
Your Honor, the words under 1402, I think, are the key phrase in the jurisdictional grant. Under, its natural meaning means in accordance with. So what Congress is saying is complete or to perfect counseling in accordance with section 1402. One of the requirements there is that a plaintiff file a claim within 180 days of the date the cause of action accrues. One of the other requirements is that the claim actually be cognizable under the CAA. So the court, the Congress, by saying under 1402, is incorporating not only the timeliness requirement, but also the requirement that this is actually an employment law that has been waived.
And when you say cognizable, what do you think that means?
I mean, it's pursuant to the waiver of immunity. For example, if you look at the congressional...
But I mean, what...
It sounds as if you're bringing in the...
Now it sounds...
...horribles that Judge Garland was referring to, in which every element of the tort becomes jurisdictional, and therefore there's interlocutory appeal at every moment.
No, Your Honor, not every element of the tort, but at least that there must be a waiver according to the terms of the Congressional Accountability Act, for example. The Congressional Accountability Act, if you look at the terms of it, does not put Congress precisely under every employment law as they apply everywhere else. For example, the FLSA is very limited in what is incorporated under the CAA. The record-keeping provisions, the child labor law provisions are not laws that Congress has waived its immunity for. So 1402 requires also that Congress actually has waived its immunity with respect to the claim you're asserting under the CAA. And that's the only place where it shows up in terms of the jurisdictional grant. I think if someone were to bring forth a suit saying the child labor laws under the CAA, we would look at it and say, no, there's no jurisdiction for that class of cases.
Which words are you referring to now when you say it has to be cognizable? Which part are you importing, 1402 or 1404?
1402, Your Honor, it says to commence a proceeding a covered employee alleging a violation of a law made applicable under Part A.
Are you only saying that it has to allege a violation of the law under Part A? That's all
yes.
You're saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
Basically, in this case, it's ADA. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's all you're saying.
It's saying made applicable, so you have to look at the particular provision. So if there were an ADA provision that were not made applicable under the waiver of immunity, there would be no way for the subject matter.
Which ADA provision is not applicable?
I'm not saying there is. In here, Your Honor, the ADA provisions are applicable. However, under other provisions of the law, for example, the FLSA, the Title VII retaliation provision, have not been incorporated. So in Section 1408, Congress incorporating the entirety of 1402.
Saying, so retaliatory action under the ADA is not included? Is that what you're saying?
There is a separate retaliation provision under the Congressional Accountability Act.
Uh-huh. And what about the elements of an ADA claim? Are those all jurisdictional also, on your view?
No, Your Honor.
They're not?
No. Okay. Just the terms that are set forth. The class of cases set forth in Section 1408, and that means it needs to be a civil action alleged by a person who is a covered employee who has completed or perfected counseling in accordance with Section 1402.
It doesn't say in accordance. It just says under Section 1402.
Your Honor, Webster's and Oxford has in accordance as one of the definitions of under.
I can just try to explore your contention more. You're arguing, I think, a parallelism between under Section 1402 and under Section 1404. And your earlier discussion, I may not have, if I don't have 1404 correctly in mind, tell me. But that is where you're arguing that a discrimination claim not made applicable to Congress by the Congressional whatever, Accountability Act, if it clearly didn't allege the things that are necessary to be alleged to fit within the act, then there would be no jurisdiction.
No,
I mean, we certainly do have statutes which say that there's no jurisdiction unless there is an allegation of a particular type.
No, you know, Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that every 12b-6 argument is jurisdictional. It's only because Congress set forth in Section 1408, it's entitled Civil Action. Subsection A is actually entitled Jurisdiction, and that's the clause that sets forth the classes of cases over which the district court has power to adjudicate.
Then you're making a retreat that I'm a little puzzled by. In other words, you're saying there's no problem under 1408 with a civil action that raises a type of claim not countenanced by the Congressional Accountability Act. Is that right?
No, Your Honor. What I'm saying is 1402 by expressly incorporating 1408 by expressly incorporating 1402
yeah.
gets that requirement in. because in order to convict to a covered employee may, alleging a violation of a law made applicable. So it has to be a law that's made applicable.
Okay.
So to the extent, going back, it's taken me a long time to get here, going back to Judge Garland's point that it doesn't say timely exhaustion, it does say that by saying, by incorporating under 1402. To the extent it would have said timely exhaustion, it would have been redundant and also under broad. Because by incorporating under Section 1402, you're also incorporating that requirement that it actually has to be a law that was made applicable under the Congressional Accountability Act.
And if you look at the
legislative history, it's clear that timely exhaustion...
There isn't legislative history. There is a single line-by-line analysis introduced by a single senator, right?
By the two co-sponsors of the litigation...
Right.
And in,
you would agree that this is generally this kind of legislative history, which is something added during a floor debate, is not generally regarded as the strongest kind. This is not a committee report, right?
It is not a committee report, but in the Donovan case, this court has held that the section-by-section analysis introduced by co-sponsors is probative of the intent of Congress. And here the intent of Congress was very clear, that the timely exhaustion requirement is part and parcel of the jurisdictional grant. It makes clear that if you fail to request counseling within the time required, it bars an employee from proceeding under the Act. And if you look at that language as compared to, for example, the legislative history pointed out in the Zipes case with respect to Title VII, it's completely different. The legislative history under Title VII suggests that Congress was okay with it being equitably told. That's not the language we have here. Congress made it clear that it made a reasoned decision to waive its own immunity from suit and put itself under various employment laws as prescribed by itself. And when it did so, it did that in a very limited way. And the conditions on that waiver need to be strictly construed.
Can we turn to your argument, your effort to deflect Johnson versus Jones? You say at a number of points, well, both in your opening brief and your reply brief, that the sergeant-at-arms is not contesting, for purposes of this motion, the facts alleged by the plaintiff. And you seem to think that that throws Johnson versus Jones out of the picture. But Johnson versus Jones, it seems to me, made perfectly clear that it did not contemplate interlocutory review under Cohen of rulings which took a sort of a complex set of facts and ruled that those, that pattern added up to that there we're dealing with qualified immunity, established the absence or presence of qualified immunity. The question of whether the law, the right violated, was clearly established. So, the line drawn in Johnson is somewhat different. It looks for something indicating a clear issue of law, clear, comparatively simple issue of law, not the sort of issue of law that's sort of the bread and butter of ordinary summary judgment actions.
Well, Your Honor, the facts here are undisputed. We've taken everything that Ms. Oscarson has said as true for purposes of this motion. And in Mitchell v. Forsythe and in Johnson v. Jones, the court said that the second prong of the collateral order doctrine is met when you're only making a legal determination based on even plaintiffs.
But not every legal determination. I think Johnson is really clear on that. There are lots of legal determinations that are not covered by it. That are not susceptible to interlocutory review under Mitchell.
Yes, Your Honor, when it's dealing with the evidence sufficiency, when it's a summary judgment motion, what was there enough facts to support a particular version of the events? Here we don't have that issue.
Don't we have the question of whether we have a set of facts which triggered the 180-day time limit?
Yes, Your Honor, and those facts are undisputed, and this court can...
Facts are undisputed, but facts can be very complicated and undisputed at the same time. That could be true with relation to the facts governing qualified immunity, and it's that kind of issue that Johnson says is not susceptible to interlocutory review.
Well, I mean, looking at a different area of the law, for example, under FISA, if it's a commercial activity, that can be a very complicated set of facts. It can be undisputed, and this court has reviewed that on an interlocutory basis. The key inquiry is whether the facts are undisputed, and here they are.
I don't think that is the key inquiry under Johnson at all.
So Johnson says that if the district court says there is a genuine issue of material fact, that you cannot have interlocutory review, right?
Your Honor, that may be, but the court has never said there's a genuine issue of material fact with respect to the accrual issue.
We don't know what the judge said here, right? It's a minute order.
It is a minute order, Your Honor, but because the review here is de novo as well as it was with the court below.
It's de novo on the question of whether there's a genuine issue of material fact, because that's the review of summary judgment, but that was also the case in Johnson. And the court said that legal question, and that's a legal question, but the court said that legal question is not one that gets interlocutory review.
Let me read you a sentence from Johnson. Where, however, a defendant simply wants to appeal the district court's determination that the evidence is sufficient to permit a particular finding of fact after trial, and then it goes on to explain that where that if clause applies, essentially we're not in the area of interlocutory appeal under Cohen.
But the denial of the district court is the denial of the claim of sovereign immunity from suit.
That's the bottom line. There's no doubt about it. But the basis of that denial can fit into the category of a sort of minute study of complicated facts as opposed to a clear ruling of law, which is what Johnson tried to limit Mitchell to.
And I believe it may be that Johnson case or the other Johnson case where the court said, unfortunately, sometimes this may require
the Barron case to look
specifically at the record and make these sort of fact-intensive discussions.
If you look carefully, you see that what it really refers to, it says it may be cumbersome and difficult even to draw the line between the type of, to ascertain from what the district court did, whether it's the sort of disposition on a basis of a clear proposition of law or simply a sort of minute fact-by-fact teasing out of whether summary judgment should or should not be granted.
Well, I think my answer is, again, I'm repeating myself, but first, it's there are no disputed facts. And when you look at these disputed facts, it's very clear.
Doesn't get you home free under Johnson.
But it's very clear under this particular set of facts that her claim is time-barred based on the assertions that she's made and all inferences in her favor. It shows that, as a matter of law, she was articulating the injury that is asserted as the basis of this lawsuit at various points from August 31st.
You think what I actually think that if their definition of delay were adopted, you would be right. Because their definition is you can sue any time up to and including the grant of the accommodation or the denial of the accommodation. And if, 180 days?
Yes.
If 180 days had passed after either of those events, then we would have a very clear issue, and that might be the end of it. But your definition is that they had to reasonably know about delay, right? What's your definition?
That she knew or should have known, and that the facts to actually show
knew or should have known what?
Of the injury that's asserted, which is the delay. The delay of receiving the accommodation.
And you think that should be the test. Is that right?
The test that has been employed by this circuit before and various other circuits is knew or should have known of the injury.
I'm asking you in the delay context, though. Could you word the test for me?
She knew or should have known of the delay in receiving the accommodation.
Right. Now, how much delay is the delay that creates an injury in your view?
The delay is the delay that the plaintiff actually believes in their experience as an employee.
But that's not enough to create a cause of action. Is your view that any time an employee thinks there's been too much delay, that's enough to recover under the ADA?
Your Honor,
doesn't it have to be, wouldn't it have to be reasonable, unreasonable delay or something like that, or not?
It does, Your Honor, but here we have an actual statement from her putting forth her point of view, which in the context and the record shows that it was, in fact, reasonable as well.
Right, unreasonable?
It was.
So you would agree, then, that there was unreasonable delay at that point?
I believe that on the record, if what she's saying is true, that she asked for an accommodation in May of 2002 and had believed that she fully documented the accommodation by November, that's a seven-month period.
Well, the position of the, I just want to be clear for the future, the position of the Office of the Senate Sergeant at Arms is a seventh-month delay is a violation of the ADA, and any employee of the Senate should know that they should be able to recover after 7 months. Is that your position?
No, Your Honor.
It's not, because it has to, because what? Because it depends on the facts of the case?
Well, it depends on the facts of the case, and obviously we're making alternative arguments. Obviously it's not a shock to the court that we don't agree with the version of the facts as put forth by the plaintiff.
Well, if you don't agree, you agree with the facts, that is, you agree that she said as of that day she hadn't gotten it.
And not only that she hadn't gotten it, but that she articulated that our response had been stalled, that we had completely dropped the ball, that she had fully documented the request, that requests for documentation were not real requests, they weren't government forms. Anyone with a belief of that should have taken...
If those things were true, you would then agree that there was a violation? 7 months with those things is a violation?
I would agree that it's not, I wouldn't necessarily, the accrual issue is different from the merits issue, Your Honor.
Well,
I would agree that someone could for that.
Why is the accrual issue different from the merits? It only accrues if a meritorious claim has occurred by that time, right? If it would take another 2 months before it becomes a meritorious claim, then they would have to wait another 2 months, wouldn't they?
No, Your Honor. I mean, claims accrue irrespective of whether you're going to win on the merits all the time. We see a plethora of cases in the district court with respect to employment laws where a claim accrues, but the person may not necessarily
imagine
win.
Imagine the rule were that it takes 9 months of delay before it's sufficiently unreasonable to make out a claim, and she sued after only 7 months, and she thought 7 months was enough. You think they have to sue before a meritorious claim has arisen?
Your Honor, the burden is on the plaintiff to take steps to investigate their legal rights once they're on notice of an injury. So if a person believes that the delay is harming them, that they are owed something, they have the duty to then investigate whether a claim is cognizable. And the newer should have known standard appropriately balances the interest between the plaintiffs and the defendants in litigation. And especially in the ADA context, for example, where the point of these failure to accommodate claims is to provide a disabled employee with the tools they need in order to do their job. So if a person actually believes they can't do their job and that they're owed an accommodation, it actually furthers the point of the ADA to ensure that this person promptly files in order to get equitable relief and monetary relief for any alleged delay.
We'll let you come back. Mr. Kuhlman?
It pleases the court. My name is Avi Kuhn. I'm representing the plaintiff appellee, in this case, Wendy Oskarson. The court, I think, was right on point in terms of questioning the sergeant-at-arms about the jurisdictional question in this case. The sergeant-at-arms has asked this court to make several illogical leaps in order to be entitled to interlocutory review. They've taken a garden-variety timeliness question, dressed that up as a jurisdictional issue, dressed that up as a sovereign immunity issue, dressed that up as a claim that they're entitled to sovereign immunity even for claims of federal sovereign immunity, which the case law does not support, and then claim that they can bring that petition for interlocutory review at any time, even if they have sat on their rights.
What if Congress had said a condition on the waiver of our sovereign immunity is a timely filing of a request for counseling?
That's correct, but 1408...
What if they had said that? And under those circumstances,
under
you
those
would agree...
Under those circumstances, I agree with you.
There would be interlocutory appeal.
That's right. Typically for most issues of subject matter jurisdiction, but not necessarily in the context of federal sovereign immunity.
Well, what about congressional sovereign
about
immunity?
Federal sovereign immunity? I mean, Senate Sergeant-at-Arms cites a Westfall Act case where... Now, that's a particular form of... federal sovereign immunity.
I believe that's
but interlocutory review is approved in the strongest terms there. It hasn't got to turn on the particular statute.
I believe that's the Osborne versus Haley case that Your Honor is referring to. And in that case, it was an official immunity case. And several circuits have held that that is simply a different analysis than cases for federal sovereign immunity.
I mean, official immunity. Well, the immunity is out there. And the question, it would seem to me, in looking at a particular immunity case is statute by statute to see whether there are indications that Congress believed that it makes sense to have a threshold appealable condition on the waiver of immunity. The only clue here, as Judge Garland has said, the only item asserted by the Senate Sergeant at Arms is the wording of 1408 and its cross-references.
In reviewing the issue of immunity, several circuits have held that not all immunities are the same for the purposes of interlocutory appeal. The Seventh Circuit has held that federal sovereign immunity is not entitled to interlocutory review.
What they say about federal sovereign immunity is that there are all kinds of incursions on federal sovereign immunity, the Federal Tort Claims Act, et cetera. But those all have to do with suits against the government, qua government, or against the executive branch. This practice of the Congress permitting suits against itself is not something which, for the last 100 years, bits and bits of the sovereign immunity have been waived. This is only a mid-90s phenomenon, isn't that right?
That's correct.
And it's a pretty narrow one. There's one statute that waives only under some conditions with respect to some statutes. So even if we were to accept Judge Easterbrook's opinion for the Seventh Circuit, which this Court has not yet decided one way or the other, in fact, it's expressly said we're not deciding, why would that apply to the much more limited and much more recent waiver that Congress has provided for itself?
Well, for one, 1408 does not make timeliness a jurisdictional prerequisite.
That's a different question.
That's the question.
But that is a different question. That is, Easterbrook's position is that there have been so many waivers with respect to federal sovereign immunity that is unrelated to Congress, that now it should just be regarded as not a right not to go to trial, but an affirmative defense. Before we get to the specific waiver here, that seems to me substantial. At least we should give considerable pause before we went off the cliff that you're asking us to go off of, which is to say that, which is another series of logical steps. We first have to say the federal government has no interlocutory appeals, and then second, because Congress is part of the federal government, albeit a separate branch, therefore it doesn't get any. That seems to me a lot of cliffs to jump off.
Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that this court necessarily go as far as the Pullman decision. Pullman suggested that there can never be any federal sovereign immunity in any civil context.
You're asking us to go even further. You're saying that Congress doesn't get any either.
I'm saying that it would depend on the particular statute.
There's only one statute, isn't there?
In this case, that's correct. It's the Congressional Accountability Act. So one must look at the issue of the Congressional Accountability Act in the context of federal sovereign immunity and see if it makes out the three Cohen requirements. In terms of the Cohen requirements, I think Your Honor is correct that the Johnson case prohibits interlocutory review in this case. Johnson stated that we are persuaded that immunity appeals interfere less with the final judgment rule if they're limited to cases presenting neat abstract issues of law. But this circuit has stated repeatedly in Goldman versus Bakai, Byers versus Burleson, that the discovery rule, what a plaintiff knew and when she knew it, are classic jury issues not fit for judicial determination, certainly not for interlocutory review. Now, the sergeant at arms keeps on stating these issues.
One of the oddities of Johnson is that many of those sort of very fine-grained factual issues are things that we do review in review of a summary judgment ruling.
That may be true, Your Honor, but for the purpose of the discovery rule, and especially in this case, the sergeant at arms has asserted these facts are undisputed, but they are disputed. And in fact, later on in her argument, she stated that the sergeant at arms does not agree with the facts put forward by the plaintiff. They posit one set of facts that suggests
I'm sorry, I thought for purposes of this motion they accepted your allegations completely. that wrong?
If they accepted,
I didn't see any contest of that in your brief.
Your Honor, if they truly accepted our facts, then this would be a non-issue because Ms. Oskarson would have filed
timely. That's a different matter, but their contention certainly is that your allegations, whatever they are accepted for purposes of this motion.
And
you have to live with that unless you point me to something that contradicts it.
No, if they truly do accept our facts, then her claim was timely, Your Honor.
Let me focus on this language. Completed counseling under Section 1402. So suppose that there's not a formal start of counseling, a formal request for counseling, but the plaintiff has had a conversation with whoever he or she would get counseling from in a hallway. Defendant says, well, that's not counsel, that doesn't add up to counseling under Section 1402. Has the jurisdictional requirement, clearly counseling is a jurisdictional requirement, right? You'd accept that.
That's correct.
So does that satisfy the jurisdictional requirement?
Well, the individual would certainly have to go through counseling. There's no question about that.
Well, take my hypothetical, this casual conversation in the hallway between the requester, who doesn't request, and the counselor, who, let's assume, doesn't give any counsel.
They
have a conversation about it, and they end up passing on and shrugging.
If that conversation was not actually counseling, then no, that would not be counseling. It would not satisfy 1402.
So you are saying that counseling, there must be counseling for jurisdiction.
That's correct. But 1408 does not import a timeliness requirement into the jurisdictional requirement.
How do we know which parts of 1402 are incorporated?
Your Honor, if Congress wanted to import a timeliness requirement into that provision, they certainly know how to do that.
Everybody knows that. Why people think that a slam dunk argument, I've never understood. Obviously,
if they did tell us, we wouldn't have to have any of these cases.
Well, there are situations in which Congress does tell us. For example, the sergeant-at-arms.
You know that too.
The sergeant-at-arms points to the John R. Sand and Gravel case. That case represented a dispute over the jurisdictional statute of the Federal Court of Claims. And the Federal Court of Claims jurisdictional statute says, every claim of which the United States Court of Federal Claims has jurisdiction shall be barred unless the petition thereon is filed within 6 years. It was very clear that there was a timeliness requirement in the jurisdictional statute. 1408 does not contain a timeliness requirement. The Supreme Court has stated in multiple occasions in Irwin, in Arbaugh, in Zipes, in Citizens for a Better Government, Better Environment, rather, versus Steel Company, that if there's any doubt over that, the statute is simply not jurisdictional. The timeliness requirement is not jurisdictional in nature.
Yeah, you do read 1408 as making some kind of counseling a jurisdictional prerequisite. And what if, instead of my conversation in the hallway, the employee requests counseling from some group other than the Office of Compliance? Do we have counseling within the meaning of 1402?
Again, 1402 states that you do have to go to the Office of Compliance.
Okay. So then is that counseling under 1402?
I suppose that would not be counseling.
As the term is used in 1408?
That would not represent counseling, no.
That would not represent. Now, 1408 doesn't explicitly say counseling with the Office of Compliance, right? So why is that not counseling under 1402, while belated counseling is counseling under 1402 within the meaning of 1408?
Because I believe it's a different
issue. It's obviously different, right. But why is it different?
Because 1402, what 1408 states is that you have to go through counseling with the Office of Compliance.
And it also says the request for counseling shall be made not later than 180 days after the date of the alleged violation.
1402 says that.
Yes.
But 1408 does not incorporate that requirement.
1408 doesn't say counseling with the Office of Compliance.
It says that you have to go through the procedure set up by the Office of Compliance. It says you have to go through 1402.
It doesn't say that. It says completed counseling under Section 1402. And you've accepted the proposition that under 1402 means counseling with the Office of Compliance, but you resist the idea that it means a timely request.
And perhaps I misunderstood Your Honor's question. I believe that if somebody, let's say, went to an office other than the Office of Compliance, then certainly they would have not followed the procedures under 1402.
Well, if they don't file their request within 180 days, they also haven't followed the procedures under 1402.
And I believe that would represent a violation of 1402, but it would not represent a violation of the jurisdictional provision of 1408.
Same could be said if going to the wrong office, the Office of X rather than the Office of Compliance.
That's right, and that would represent a violation of 1402, but there's nothing in 1408, the jurisdictional provision itself, that states, and you have to do it in the following ways in order for this to be jurisdictional.
What if you focused on the words, who has completed counseling under Section 1402, as being the requirement? Now, 1402 does have what sounds like an indication of what completed counseling means, namely, the office shall notify the employee in writing when the counseling period has ended. Is that your understanding then of when someone has completed counseling that the office has to notify?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, that at least takes care of the office problem. That is, if you go to the wrong office, you don't get that notice from the right office. What happens if the office just never notifies? Then what?
Yes, I understand that concern, Your Honor. But I don't think that would be, that would certainly be an internal problem. Whether that's a jurisdictional issue, that's simply not raised in this case. I don't know, Your Honor. In terms of the facts, the Sergeant at Arms has stated repeatedly that these facts are disputed. But let me tell you briefly what the plaintiff's version of the facts are. And for the purposes of this motion, they must be accepted as true. The spring of 2003.
If they're accepted as true, then you're conceding what the defendant says is the case, that there's not a dispute over facts with relevance to this motion.
And if that were the case, then Ms. Osterson's contention is that her motion was timely filed, even under the discovery rule, that she did not know or should have known.
This doesn't get you very far, because then we would have just a legal question, which is, what is the rule?
That's correct, that it would just be a legal question, but on the merits of this appeal, Ms. Osterson would be entitled to judgment on this appeal because her matter was timely.
Do you have any idea what the district court decided on, whether the district court decided that didn't think the facts were sufficient, whether the district court liked your version of the law or the Senate's version of the law?
We don't know, Your Honor. It's simply a minute order.
And we're, both facts and law were argued, I take it.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. In terms of their discovery rule, we also believe that that is completely the wrong standard. It would set up a system in which a plaintiff's subjective belief about delay would represent a violation. But the violation under the ADA is not simply delay, it's unreasonable delay. They're positing a scenario where, for example, if a paranoid plaintiff made an accommodation request and then 5 minutes later believed that there had been a delay, that would start her obligation to file.
Your rule is any time up to denial or grant? That any time during that time it would accrue any time within that period?
That's correct, Your Honor, because we believe that an employee cannot be expected to know what the response to his or her accommodation request has been until the employer has actually given the response to the accommodation
request. Once they've given a response, what's the definition of unreasonable delay?
Once they've given a response, then an employee would have 180 days to file,
right,
and the jury would decide whether the facts of the case set forth unreasonable delay. And I suppose on a given set of facts,
what would the jury be told about what's unreasonable or not?
Well, generally, unreasonability is an issue for the jury to determine. They could certainly decide, you know what, it was the plaintiff in this case that had delayed. She didn't return the forms fast enough. She, you know, wasn't active in requesting her accommodation request. If the jury blamed the plaintiff for the delay rather than the defendant for the delay, they could certainly find that there had been no unreasonable delay.
Hearing no further questions, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Bach, how much time does she have? All right, well, that's my fault, so we'll give you another 2 minutes.
Just a few quick points. Under Arbar and Kontrick, Congress' use of the term jurisdiction, specifically in subsection A of 1408, shows Congress's intent to limit the class of cases that the district courts have power to adjudicate pursuant to Article 3 of the Constitution. By limiting their jurisdiction, Congress is explicitly retaining its longstanding immunity from suit. There was a lot of discussion about what under 1402 means. And the plain language means in accordance with. And that means it's incorporating the entire 1402, not just portions of it. That would include the timeliness requirement. It would include the requirement that the specific law that's the alleged violation is a law that actually has been waived under the Congressional Accountability Act. And would also require that the counseling occur with the Office of Compliance, as Judge Williams pointed out. To the extent that there is some ambiguity in this court's mind, that ambiguity needs to be resolved in favor of the sovereign. Waivers are to be construed narrowly, and the legislative history supports our reading, which I think is the better reading of Section 1408.
On that point about waivers being construed narrowly, what do you do with the Scarborough versus Principi opinion, in which the government made exactly the kind of argument you're making here? That is, the court says, the government insists most strenuously that the waiver of sovereign immunity from liability for fees, that was a fees case, is conditioned on the fees applicant's meticulous compliance with each and every requirement. And the court says, referring to Irwin and Franconia, court says, in these decisions, we recognize that limitations principles should generally apply to the government in the same way they apply to private parties. Once Congress waives sovereign immunity, judicial application of a time prescription to suits against the government, in the same way the prescription is applicable to private suits, amounts to little, if any, broadening of the congressional waiver. We further stated in Irwin that holding the government responsible is likely to be a realistic assessment of legislative intent, as well as practically useful principle of interpretation. And then in Arbaugh, it pretty much says that there has to be a clear statement, not just the kind of thing we're talking about here, which is sort of an implicit cross-reference and then implicitly picking up everything. Well, doesn't that sort of change the argument that we have to strictly construe a waiver? These Supreme Court cases sound like, at least with respect to timeliness, the sort of shoe is on the other foot.
Well, in those cases, the court was not construing the jurisdictional grant, the embodiment of the waiver itself. Here, we're actually construing the embodiment of the waiver itself. If you look at Irwin, that was dealing with a clear claims processing rule and not the grant of jurisdiction, which was in a completely, entirely separate section of Title VII. So to the extent, it's our position that Irwin doesn't apply at all. And to the extent it does apply, that presumption has been rebutted by the CAA's text structure and legislative history, which shows that Congress intended the jurisdictional grant to extend only to the classes of cases in which there is, among other things, a timely exhaustion of remedies. To ignore that requirement would impermissibly broaden the waiver and would contravene Congress's intent with respect to the power under Article 3 of the district courts to adjudicate the classes of cases that fall under the Congressional Accountability Act. One last point with respect to the merits. This court has made clear that the continuing violation theory does not apply to failures to accommodate, and it made that very clear in Mayors versus Laborers Health. There's no further questions.
Thanks very much. Case will be submitted.
Case number 07-1328, American Forest and Paper Association, Inc. Petitioner versus Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Mr. Seip for the petitioner, Mr. Solomon for the respondent.
Could we, while counsel are changing chairs, if we could have a brief break? Thank you. We have some foreign visitors with us today. I'm going to give the floor to Senior Judge Williams to welcome them.
I just want to welcome our Russian visitors who are here actually mainly inquiring into how American criminal law proceeds, but this will at least give them some variety. Dobry przyjechać.
Yeah. So don't commit any crimes while you guys are coming up here, please. All right, Mr. Seifert.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Don Seip. I'm here for the appellant AFPA in this case. I would like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This case comes to this Court as an appeal from an order of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission interpreting Section 210M of PURPA. In interpreting one subsection of that statute, the Commission has found that the markets that are available to QFs to relieve a utility of its mandatory purchase obligation do not have to be competitive, do not have to provide a meaningful opportunity to make sales, and in fact, that evidence of transactions within those markets are not relevant to the Commission's determination under the statute about whether those markets qualify. AFPA believes that's an unreasonable interpretation of the statute. We rely on a plain language reading of the statute without relying on rules of statutory construction or anything else. We believe the word...
That's part of your case that you're setting aside the ordinary rules of statutory construction?
The ordinary rules of statutory construction demonstrate that the Commission's reading is wrong. The ordinary rules of statutory construction...
We're not throwing them out the window.
No. We use them to demonstrate that the Commission's reading is incorrect for several reasons.
Go ahead.
That's a clarification. When I go to my stockbroker and ask him to go to the market and get me the best deal that he can, he understands perfectly well that I'm not asking him to go to the grocery store and pick up a cheap cart of groceries. And that's because that conversation occurs within a context, a context where it is well understood what his role is, what my expectations are. 210M is not a snippet of isolated text. It is part of a long and ongoing conversation between the Congress and the courts and the Commission.
Yes, 210M1A is part of a very specific conversation which includes 210M1B and C.
Yes.
Right? So you have to explain why the omission of the word competitive in A is utterly meaningless. The norm, the absolutely standard inference that courts draw every day of the week should not be drawn in that case.
And we have argued, Your Honor, that the reason that that inference is not legitimate in this case is because there is a long history of interpretation of the word markets, which includes that. If you apply that rule of statutory construction, for instance, to A, we'll go with A first and then we'll go with C, because C has the same problem, you'll find out. If we go with A, we must presume that it is possible to have access to markets in which QFs have no meaningful opportunity to make sales. The word access to a market has to imply an opportunity to make sales. If the word access is deprived of a word market which has some meaning, there's evidence of transactions or not, can't be argued to argue that you don't have access to a market. But let's also go down to C.
The key proposition was competitive. You recognize that there are competitive and not competitive markets, right? So use of the word market alone suggests that non-competitive markets are included.
It does not under the FPA, Your Honor. The FPA, this Court, has been extremely clear, just like I've been extremely clear with my stockbroker. There is repeated precedent that every market relied upon by the Commission must be competitive. If we look at what this rule of...
Actually, the cases you rely on don't revolve around the construction of the word market in a statute. They revolve around how the Commission is to go about its duty of assuring that prices are just and reasonable.
Exactly,
which is quite a different matter.
Well, exactly, Your Honor.
But if it's exactly, then it's not a definition of the word market that's at issue in those cases.
No, it's a definition of the word just and reasonable rates, which QFs are entitled to. And that's the point. If we apply the same rule to C, for instance, we would have to presume C only uses the word competitive. we could apply the winning argument that if Congress had intended there to be a meaningful opportunity to sell and see, they would have said it, right? Because the normal interpretation is that we would read that as not being included in there for a reason.
Well, they say of comparable competitive quality.
Yes, but...
So if Congress thought that the markets... Now, let me just back up one step. You agree with the Commission that the intent of A little I is to cover the four RTOs that they describe, MISO, PJM, ISO New England, and New York ISO.
Actually, the intent of A is to set forth a particular market structure. Currently, it covers a certain
and those
part
are
the of the
ones.
Country.
Those are the ones. Those are auction-based, day-ahead, and real-time wholesale markets, right?
Those are auction-based day-ahead. That's A1.
Right. So those are the ones that they're referring to there. And why is it unreasonable for the Commission to say, well, Congress had in mind auction-based day-ahead real-time wholesale markets, and those kind of markets are competitive, at least in that area, and there's a reason, good reason to believe that they will be reasonably competitive or somewhat competitive for the wholesale markets for long-term sales.
Surprisingly.
And so when Congress says in C, comparable competitive, that doesn't mean competitive pure. That just means compared to the competitive quality of the A market.
If, in fact, Congress had presumed that the markets in A2 were competitive, there was nothing for the Commission to do. There was no need to have A2 in the statute at all. It's completely superfluous. If they wanted
they
to say,
to
if they
that,
wanted to say well, RTOs.
That's not what we're still talking about. There still have to be markets for long-term sales. And FERC says that if you show bilateral contracts of greater than or equal to 1 year, that shows that. But something has to, you may argue about whether that's good enough, but there is an additional requirement.
The additional requirement is access. If you can have access to markets, the requirement in A in all these sections is access.
Well, that's a,
if
that's
the
a,
argument is that you can have...
That's a, not a requirement in A. That's a requirement in M1, right?
That's a requirement for all of these
right,
markets.
Right, that's a non-discriminatory access requirement.
Access to what is the question. If we presume that the issue of whether or not there are transactions in these markets that QFs can partake in is not an issue of access, and that these markets can be determined without any regard to whether they're competitive, then we may as well presume that QFs have access to the surface of the moon, because there have been transactions between the Earth and the moon, and no one is arguing, as the Commission might say, that if QFs were allowed to be astronauts, you couldn't have access to the surface of the moon. But if you drain the word markets of the idea of having real access, of having an ability to make sales, of having some quantum, identifiable quantum of competition, you can't even reasonably say that a QF has access to these markets.
You're accepting, though, that the auction-based day-ahead and real-time markets are competitive.
We are not.
You aren't.
No, we don't need to. That is for the Commission to determine. The auction-based day-ahead real-time markets, for instance, the you know, ruling that you have to be independent.
What happens is that the suppliers offer prices, and the system essentially peels off the transactions, working up the supply curve to a point where the market clears. Isn't that basically the way the auctions work, right?
They may work that way. There may also be market dysfunction within those markets. We've had experience in California where we've had extreme market dysfunction.
California is B. It's not A, right?
California was up in A, had a real-time market.
I understand that, but it's not included by FERC under A. Am I wrong?
It's not. What we're arguing is what are the factual predicates for A? And the factual predicates for A include that market, but they also include a requirement of independence. If FERC found evidence, if I came in and I could show, and I'm not saying it's likely, it's not a question of whether I'm likely to prevail, if I could come in and show that, in fact, the independent market monitors in this were taking bribes from the utilities, if I had a QF that could show that the administration was not independent, FERC would have an obligation under the APA
We would not win under
A1 the way the Commission interprets the statute. The Commission interprets the statute that we cannot put in evidence on that, just as we cannot put in evidence on the competitiveness of the markets.
You can put in evidence on non-discriminatory access, correct?
Non-discriminatory access.
You can put in evidence on that, right?
Non-discriminatory access. That was my earlier point. If to have non-discriminatory access, you must have an opportunity to make sales.
Hold on for 1 second.
Yes.
There is a rebuttable presumption with respect to non-discriminatory access, which means you can put in evidence, right?
We cannot put in evidence on the competitiveness of the market.
I didn't ask you that question. With respect to whether there's non-discriminatory access.
Access is meaningless without an opportunity
to make
sales.
In the example that you just gave,
yes.
If there were bribery that prevented QF from getting in, you think that FERC would not describe that as discriminatory access?
What FERC would do is they would find that there is an independently, they have already made the ruling that MISO qualifies. Correct?
But they left open for you the possibility of showing discriminatory access. That's what it means to have a rebuttable presumption.
Under FERC's ruling, the fact that I don't have a meaningful opportunity to make a sale is not an argument that I have access.
So if I ask the FERC attorney whether it's true that bribery can't be shown by you as a means of blocking access, and he said, of course it can, then you're going to withdraw from your position?
No, because they are also telling us that other things that are perfectly relevant that they have an obligation to consider under the APA are not relevant. For instance, down below, ELCON actually did try to put in evidence that the markets were non-competitive. What the commission ruled was, in fact, not that they had looked at that evidence and found it wanting, not that they had looked and found that these markets were competitive. What they found, in fact, was that that was inapposite, as in irrelevant, as in we will not look at it.
That follows from their construction of A in the context of A, B, and C.
So the question of access. If a QF comes in and says, we do not have access to these markets because we do not have any opportunity to make sales, whether it's because it's bribery, whether it's because there's no market opportunity, they cannot put in that evidence under FERC's ruling. FERC has said such evidence is inapposite, and it drains the word access of meaning. It drains the word markets of meaning.
One of the suppliers in the market is bribing the ISO.
That's just one example of something that you might be able to show.
Let's stick with that. And,
sure.
And you're saying that under what FERC has said, that's irrelevant to the question of whether there's non-discriminatory access?
FERC has literally told you that it does not want to be relitigating over and over again whether these markets are independent. It has said that in its brief. It has pled that.
Just to stick with this hypothetical,
which means it
you've
won't.
Given us, FERC would say, in terms of whether there's non-discriminatory access, what you have alleged is irrelevant.
What FERC has said is there is no reason to relitigate over and over again whether it satisfies the requirements of A1. They have ruled that, which means I take it, if you take them at their word, not at what he may say when he comes up here. The basis of his decision is that, no, I cannot come in and challenge that. That is an irrebuttable presumption. Number one, that they are independent. Number two, that this is not a rebuttable presumption. And if I cannot argue under access that I cannot have access to a meaningful opportunity to make sales, then what am I arguing? And I can't argue that they're not independent because that's an irrebuttable presumption. And there's no content to the word markets that I can appeal to. What am I allowed to come in and argue as a QF? How do I demonstrate that I don't have access to markets that don't give me any meaningful opportunity? Isn't that what I'm supposed to be showing FERC, that I don't have a meaningful opportunity to make a sale?
Okay, we'll give a chance for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Get her hear from FERC.
May it please the Court, Robert Solomon for the Commission. Turning to the last point first, yes, of course, the Commission would consider any evidence proffered, certainly bribery, concerning non-discriminatory access to the markets defined in A, B, and C. You can find this in our regulations, 18 CFR, Section 292.309E. There's some confusion with respect to non-discriminatory access to the statutorily defined markets and the markets themselves. but the statute focuses on non-discriminatory access to certain types of markets defined in A, B, and C, and what the Commission has determined in that regulation is that the qualifying facility may rebut the presumption by showing inter alia evidence of transmission constraints that hinder the ability of the qualifying facility to reach the enumerated markets, or operational circumstances peculiar to that particular qualifying facility that might have the same effect.
What about, to use a term I just learned, A Romanet 2, namely wholesale markets for long-term sales of capacity and electric energy? That the determination that the four RTOs fit there was based on the existence of bilateral contracts, right?
Yes.
What if counsel came in with evidence that while there may have been bilateral contracts last year, there haven't been any since, and there was only one, and there are no other bilateral contracts? Would they be able to put in that evidence, or is this a permanent decision?
I don't think it is permanent, and I think the QF would be able to put in that type of information. The Commission did make the generic finding in its rulemaking last year that the four types of regional transmission organizations, based upon the facts in place at the time the agency made the generic finding, satisfies the requirements of 210M1A. But presumably, if those facts have changed, and the relevant facts would, of course, be whether there are independently administered, auction-based, day-ahead, real-time markets with at least some indicia of long-term sales of capacity and electric energy, certainly the qualifying facility, either in response to electric utility filing or in a complaint or a filing to reinstate the mandatory purchase obligation, would be able to make that showing.
That would come under, I don't know, section or subsection M4?
Yes.
As a change in conditions?
Yes, as a change in conditions, that the circumstances, the conditions set forth in subparagraphs A, B, or C, which relieve the obligation to purchase, are no longer met. The Commission disagrees with petitioner. The Commission is not draining the statute of any meaning. The Commission is trying to give meaning and effect to the markets identified in A, B, and C. Those markets are identified with remarkable specificity and remarkable understanding of current markets as they have developed in the last 30 years of PURPA. The petitioner argues that the agency believes that competition is irrelevant. As the Commission said in the rehearing order, paragraphs 43 to 45, that's pages 256 to 258 of the joint appendix, the Commission believes that the Congress believes that, in fact, the markets identified in A are competitive. Judge Garland, you are correct. The reference to comparable competitive quality in C does not suggest that the markets in A are just as competitive as the markets in B. As you indicated, the markets in A may be reasonably or somewhat competitive, but the Commission believes that Congress presumes, based upon the specificity of the language employed and the reference to comparable competitive quality, that in fact the markets identified in A do have a competitive quality.
What was the exact section of part of 309 that you cited to deal with Mr. Sipes, the hypothetical that Mr. Sipes and we had been dealing with at the close of his argument?
I cited to 18 CFR 292.309E. B, C, D, and E refer to the rebuttable presumptions that the commission has designed in this case. First of all, Judge Garland, there was a question as to the status of California. California does not fall into A. California falls into B, I. The commission did not make a rebuttable presumption as to B,
and the Southwest Power Pool both.
Correct.
What about their argument that you're really not giving anything more to A, little, double little I, by merely saying that, how many bilateral contracts did the commission find?
The commission did not make a finding of a particular number, but the commission found, and none of the many parties to this proceeding disagreed, that in fact there are bilateral contracts for long-term sales of capacity and electric energy. We know this because these types of transactions have to be reported to the agency, and again, none of the parties disagree with this. The agency.
There's a difference between saying there are bilateral contracts and there are a lot, or even enough to indicate there's a market. A single bilateral contract, I suppose, wouldn't be enough, or would it? Do you think that's enough to establish that there's a wholesale market?
I would say that one would be enough, but what the commission found is little II is influenced by little I. The commission.
I wish you'd explain exactly the causal relationship there.
Well, the commission believes that there is a causal relationship between the independently administered auction-based day-ahead and real-time markets enumerated in I and the wholesale markets in double I. As the commission said in its final rule on page 154 and reiterated in its rehearing order on page 241, the commission believes that the existence of the markets in I will help promote the development of the markets in double I, in particular, the day-ahead and the real-time markets are organized markets.
And the mechanism of that influence is what exactly?
Well, the mechanism is that the real-time day-ahead markets provide a spot market benchmark that the commission believes that participants in the long-term market can use for purposes of negotiating long-term rates.
Price disclosure.
Yes, price disclosure, as well as backstopping ability in the long-term market should, for operational or economic reasons, the long-term supplier wish to go into the short-term markets. You do have a very liquid short-term market to allow the long-term supplier to take advantage of. Finally, with respect to generic findings and rebuttable presumptions, the agency does have the ability in 210A to prescribe and from time to time revise such rules as it determines necessary. And with respect to section 210M3, which is the particular provision involving commission review, all that section does is provide for an electric utility filing, the setting forth the factual basis, and notice and comment. Those words do not preclude generic findings and rebuttable presumptions. And in particular, the last part of that section that petitioner does not reference is the fact that the agency needs to make a decision within 90 days. The Congress directed the agency to act in a timely and expedited manner, and the generic findings and the rebuttable presumptions allow the agency to do precisely that.
And the question,
Mr. Sipes says that he can't rebut this presumption unless he's able to show the competitiveness of the market. Now, does the agency's finding preclude that kind of evidence?
The agency's findings preclude that type of showing if nothing has changed since the time of the agency's generic finding. The agency believed that it was actually fair to qualifying facilities and fair to electric utilities to make the findings as to the composition of the market in the generic rulemaking proceeding, because, of course, in the generic rulemaking proceeding, you had the entire qualifying facility and electric utility industry present. At some point, the agency had to make a generic finding as to the markets enumerated in A, B, or C, and if the commission had not done that in the rulemaking proceeding, it would have done so in the first adjudication presented to it, in which you would have only had the defined electric utility and the defined qualifying facility.
Can I return again to Mr. Sipes' bribery hypothetical, and particularly in the context of 309E? I take it that your answer critically depends on the words inter alia, because the specific things that are mentioned in terms of lack of access are operational characteristics of the QF or transmission constraints. Bribery does not seem to fit readily into either of those. Am I right?
Yes, but...
I think it's a little hard to work out the bribery scenario.
Right, because...
As a practical matter, once it's found, presumably action will occur to remove the bribe taker.
That is correct, because bribery is neither operational characteristics nor transmission constraints. I should point out, with respect to bribery or market manipulation or any type of anti-competitive effect, the advantage of the markets identified in A little I, the day-ahead real-time wholesale markets, is, in fact, you have market monitors in place to ferret out that type of bribery, and you have market mitigation in place of the type that perhaps you might not have in markets B and C to remediate any such bribery of the type referenced by petitioner.
AFPA argues that they need market-based rates, otherwise they don't get just and reasonable rates. Is it open to QF to file a complaint that the rates aren't just and reasonable in a particular situation or not?
Yes, but we're moving several steps ahead. All this rulemaking does is enumerate the circumstances in which the mandatory purchase obligation is rescinded. The qualifying facility remains the qualifying facility. The qualifying facility has the advantage of several exemptions under the Federal Power Act, but a qualifying facility that is greater than 20 megawatts still has to make a filing under the Federal Power Act, under Section 205 of that act, demonstrating that if it wants to sell at market-based rates, it has to have no market power or has to have effectively mitigated any market power. This is not a Federal Power Act just and reasonable case yet. It may be if the qualifying facility loses the mandatory purchase obligation, but that is a determination for a later time and a later case.
That's with respect to the obligation to purchase, right? I'm asking,
yes.
With respect to the obligation to purchase, they could in a later time, in a later case.
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Sipe, no time left, but we'll give you 2 more minutes. Could you just comment on that last point? I wasn't exactly clear.
On which last point?
About whether you have an opportunity later to make a just and reasonable rates claim.
The opportunity later to make a just and reasonable rates claim under 206 is outside of 210M. The whole point of 210M was to give QFs a particular remedy for unjust and reasonable rates. And removing that particular remedy for unjust and reasonable rates is not justified by the fact that we can come back under some other section of the statute and argue that we should be treated like any other generator. The whole purpose of PURPA was to create a special rule that would allow a special type of relief, and we are still under those rules. I don't know which order I'm arguing against here. In answer to your question, Your Honor, he told you we could put in evidence. In answer to your question, he told you that it would be precluded. It's very clear that the evidence is precluded under their order. It's very clear they did not make a generic finding that these markets are competitive. They made a generic finding that competitiveness is not important. It's not an issue. They did not take evidence and find these markets were competitive. They did not look at any particular level of transactions. They are absolutely clear that evidence of transactions are irrelevant, and if we raise them, they will be considered irrelevant. And when Elcon did, they acted on it and considered it an apposite. There is no substance to a market which does not allow meaningful access, meaningful opportunity to sell. There is no substance to the word access.
What's your scenario in which you have the auction markets that satisfy A1? There's no operational problem with the QF in terms of supplying that market. There's no transmission constraint. What's the difficulty?
The difficulty lies specifically with long-term sales, not with short-term sales, but with finding a long-term buyer in a market which is dominated by utilities and utility affiliates, just as it was under the original PURPA. The difficulty is, and the issue is, not whether we will be able to prove that there is, in fact, a lack of a competitive opportunity. That's not the issue before this court. We're not here arguing, trying to convince you the facts. Elcon tried to argue the facts below. We think it's significant when they tried to argue the facts, they were told they were irrelevant. The question is it relevant? And we believe that it is. We believe that those facts, you know, we haven't repealed the Administrative Procedures Act. This commission retains an obligation to listen to relevant evidence if it's brought forward, and they have told you they will not. He has told you specifically he will not.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Seip. Thank you, Mr. Solomon. The case will be submitted.